Hello, everyone. Rita McGrath here. You probably knew that. My fireside guest this week is Kelly Richmond Pope, who is the author of this terrific book on fraud of all things. It's called Fool Me Once, and it is a fascinating read. Just as we're getting settled into the webinar, let me just remind you, this is being recorded, so don't say anything that you don't want your grandmother or your friendly local police officer to know about. And we will have these up on YouTube for those of you that can't make it live in a few extra days. And if you'd like to refer your friends or have someone else watch them, please do so. And we will watch the chat. If we don't get to your questions live, we'll follow up with a note to those of you that put in questions or comments. So welcome, Professor Richmond Pope.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm really good. So your topic, which fascinated me, and we started talking about doing this session months ago, right? But just this morning, I got a call from my assistant who fell for a scam.
Really? What was the scam? Please tell.
Well, she had an email purporting to be from Microsoft saying that she had something she needed to adjust in her computer.
Those tech scams are good ones.
And so she tried to call her tech guy, and he was temporarily unavailable. And there was this really convenient 800 number on the website, and she called it. And the guy got access to her whole computer. It's a ransomware attack. She's completely locked out of it. And I just thought, wow, of all the days to have learned about this on a day when I'm interviewing like one of the world's experts on fraud.
But you know, it's interesting what you said, because she actually tried to call her tech person and that person was unavailable. So had that person been available, maybe she wouldn't have fallen victim.
Right. Yeah. And it's, so I guess it's what you call an accidental victim, right?
It's his fault or her fault. Whoever that tech person that wasn't available, is their fault.
They can't be available 24/7. Well, anyway, so tell me how you came to write this book, because it's super interesting.
Well, you know, I've been in the accounting space. So by background, I'm an accounting professor. And then from that, I ventured off into forensic accounting. And then from that, I ventured off into filmmaking. But all of them are related because numbers tell stories. And so for a very long time, I had been going around doing on-camera interviews or even podcast interviews with whistleblowers, white collar offenders, and victims of fraud. And I'd been collecting all of these stories and all this content for so many years. And finally, a friend of mine said, you should just write a book. And I said, really? But if I'm going to write a book, I need to figure out a way to truly add something to the literature. And so I didn't want to just tell stories, but I wanted to really figure out a way to organize different perpetrators, organize different whistleblowers, and then sandwich in how we can understand victims. And so that archetype system that's introduced in the book is really what I wanted to offer to the fraud community at large, because I didn't just want to write a book about numbers and stories, but I wanted to figure out a way to organize it. And one of the things that I do with my graduate students is we have white collar offenders, whistleblowers, victims come to class and share their stories. And through the years, I've watched how my students have responded differently, depending on the type of perpetrator it is, depending on the type of whistleblower it is. So that's really where this archetype system came from really observation of years in the classroom, of watching people either respond positively or empathetically to the various stories that they were interacting with. So that's where it all started.
That's really interesting. And, you know, one of the things that struck me as I went through the book, and I was saying before we officially began, I made the mistake of sort of trying to leaf through the book one night when I had promised myself I was going to go to bed early. And I literally couldn't put it down. It's like one story just leads to another. And one of the things that is most interesting to me about the book is how you really introduce these perpetrators as rich, complex human beings with all these different motivations and all these different sort of ways of behaving. And I was thinking of it too, is there was just a newspaper story out about one of the most famous bank robbers of all time, who's been living this secret life for like 50 years and just told his daughter about it. And you know, it's the sort of character that I could imagine popping up in the book.
Well, one of the things that I think where we may have a misconception, and I think the media helps with this misconception, is thinking that everyone is stealing because they're greedy, because they want more, because they want to live this lavish lifestyle. And that is one profile of a perpetrator, but not all profiles. And so I really wanted to expand people's minds to almost look in the mirror and say, this could be you at one point in time, not because you might want to live lavishly, but because you could have been following the boss's orders, or you could have been trying to help someone. So, you know, that's where the different categories come from in the book, and those categories being intentional perpetrators, accidental perpetrators, and righteous perpetrators. So which one could you possibly be is the wild card. So I created a game that can help you figure out that. So we'll talk about that at the end. But that's really just helping people understand this could be you. It's not them, but it's actually us.
Well, and I thought that was very powerful. And so you did a documentary called All the Queen's Horses, which I haven't had a chance to read yet. But the central character is also named Rita.
She is.
That's the one of the stories that you open the book with. So maybe tell our listeners something about her and why she's so central to the book.
Sure. So the Rita Cronwell, All the Queen's Horses story. So I did a documentary that came out back in 2017 and is still relevant today, but it is about this woman who was the city comptroller of Dixon, Illinois, Rita Cronwell. And she worked for the city for over 20 years until one day it was discovered that she had embezzled $53.7 million over 20 years. Of course, people were shocked. And let me tell you about Dixon, Illinois. So Dixon, Illinois is the quintessential small town, a little under 16,000 people population, place where everybody knows everyone. You probably don't want to lock your doors at night. And they had this trusted person called Rita. And so no one would have ever suspected that she was embezzling millions and millions of dollars for that length of time. She's so central to the book because that story is throughout the entire book, because Rita Cronwell is an example of an intentional perpetrator, but everyone is not Rita. So there are other stories that are in other categories that still hold the title of perpetrator, but are not like Rita. So the problem is, I think if we all identify ourselves as just this one category, then we shut ourselves off ever believing that that could be us. And so Rita was an intentional perpetrator. The town of Dixon is an organizational target. The citizens of Dixon are innocent bystanders. And then the person that discovered the fraud is an accidental whistleblower. So all of these little terms that I'm throwing out here are chapters in the book. So the All the Queen's Horses story, or the Dixon fraud, is that through story without the book. So you can watch the movie and read the book, or you can read the book and watch the movie. Either or, you'll still find both of them full of information and different pieces of information. Also, when doing documentary filmmaking, one of the things that you can only do is you can only show the story that people are willing to share with you on camera. But there's so many other opinions that you want to get out. And so the book offered a really good outlet for all of those side stories or my opinions or what I thought I could get those out that I couldn't do on camera.
And I love that. And she's, and you never actually have met her, I'm told.
Oh, no, I'm sure she cannot stand me at this point. I'm probably not her favorite person because, when I finished the documentary and I was doing film festivals, and it's gone to film festivals all over the world at this point, in New Zealand, in Australia, Canada, but it streamed on Netflix from 2018 to 2019. So at the very beginning of the filmmaking process, who would have ever thought that this accounting professor in Chicago's documentary would show up on Netflix? Like, and so now you have your face just plastered on Netflix, her face, sometimes a whistleblower's face. And it did really well when it was there, and now lives on Amazon Prime. So I'm certain I'm not her favorite person.
I think so. So she's a category of what you call intentional perpetrators, but you've also got the unintentional ones, right?
The accidentals and the righteous. So I'll describe the accidental, because you might know this person, or it could be you. And this person, an accidental perpetrator, is a people pleaser, a team player, a person that follows the boss's orders, follows the superior's orders, and really doesn't push back. You might think, God, this feels wrong, but you're not going to say anything because you like to keep the peace. You're not a confrontational person. And you might find that agreeing with what the boss said to do could lead you into a fraudulent situation. And there are stories in the book about those accidental perpetrators. What I started to notice through the years that I was observing with my graduate students was when intentional perpetrators would come to class and share their story, they'd be like, throw the book at them. They're terrible. Why'd they do that? But when the accidental perpetrators came to class, they're like, just pause, because they're thinking, wow, I see how that could happen. Wow, that could really be me. Wow, I was trusting in this system and the system really didn't support me. And now here I am. So that's the accidental perpetrator. The righteous perpetrator is a little similar with the intentional perpetrator, but here's the difference. They are a well-liked superstar in the organization. Either they are your CEO, CFO, top sales earning person. Everybody loves this person and everybody fears this person at the same time. You don't want to upset them. You want to keep them happy. And this person is so powerful internally that they don't necessarily think that the rules apply to them. They actually can bend the rules to get really whatever they want. And so they might decide to bend a rule to help another person. And that's the righteous perpetrator. So you have to, there's a different status level in an organization that a righteous perpetrator has.
Well, and you tell the story of, his name's escaping me now, the CEO of Vista Partners. Very famously retired the student debt of some
huge. At Morehouse. Yeah.
And then got sued by the federal government for not.
Well, and you know, I talk about, his name just slipped me, the CEO. Right. I talk about him. The interesting thing is, although I put him in the righteous perpetrator category, what's a nuance about his story is it's not as though his wrong was related to his right. Meaning, yes, he did a good thing by paying the debts off of that graduating class of Morehouse College. And that's a great thing. But we don't know enough if the tax evasion claims he did that because of that. You know, so the righteous perpetrator cases that are in that chapter are, there's one story that comes to mind. Her name, she was a lawyer. Her name was Kayla Ravello. She actually went to Columbia Law School years ago. And she was a superstar in her law firm. And what she did was allowed her husband to become one of their vendors. So she told him, you know, if you set up a copy business, you could probably bid for this proposal that we have out, and you could be selected and you could service our clients. I don't have to tell anyone that you're my husband, but I'm going to play everything by the book. And so she did up until a certain point. But my point is, she used her internal power and influence to get her husband onboarded with her organization. So she's more of the quintessential righteous perpetrator.
Yeah. And there's another example in the book about someone who stole a lot of money, but also used it to help friends meet cash flow problems and pay off debt and stuff like that. So we can kind of get sucked into these. And then what I do think happens is there is a psychological behavior that causes people, after they've done something wrong, to sort of, it's cognitive dissonance, right? So I'm not a bad person. I did this thing and maybe it wasn't the right thing, but it's justified because fill in the blank, right? my boss is badly, so it's okay for me to steal pencils or whatever it is.
Right. And we do that a lot. I mean, even outside of fraudulent situations, we always are trying to rationalize why what we did is okay. You know, so we all do that. So what's interesting is I think the decision-making of the fraudster, we'll use him as an example, is a very universal feeling that a lot of us use. We can rationalize why we can speed. We can rationalize why we can text while driving. We can rationalize so many wrongs, even outside of fraud.
So just in case you're just joining us, the book is called Fool Me Once. It's by my guest, Kelly Richmond Pope. And we're talking about fraud and the enormous role that it plays, you know, in life. So you've got your intentional perpetrators, you've got your accidental perpetrators, you've got your righteous perpetrators. But you also take a good chunk of the book to talk about the people and organizations that become victims of fraud. And one of the things that's really struck me as I was reading the book was how much an opening gets left by trusting people. And it's a really fascinating workplace conundrum, right? Because on the one hand, and it goes beyond fraud, right? But on the one hand, we've got, you know, internal controls and compliance and all that stuff. And that gets a bad rap, right? Because, it's bureaucratic. And why do I have to fill out all these forms? And why do I have to submit all these, you know, paperwork and all this stuff? So it gets kind of a bad reputation. But at the other side, if you do trust people and you say, hey, you know, use your own best judgment, you don't need to document this, take as many vacation days as you want. You know, for most people, it's going to work out fine. But there is that percentage that's going to take advantage. Yeah.
I think that's interesting. And I do think one of the things we need to do within organizations is elevate our training and the compliance function. So if you are just about forms, if you're just about, did you read the policy, check the box, sign here, then you're not touching the thought process around what happens when a person is in situation in a moment. So if you give people scenario-based training, I think that they're more able to say, yeah, maybe I would do this, or maybe I wouldn't do this, or now I see how this policy is violated because I'm actually showing you a scenario as opposed to just telling you the rule. I mean, it's almost just like driving. How many of us know the speed limit? We know the speed limit, but how many of us on a regular basis speed? Even if it's just over, even if it's 5 miles over. So we know the rules, but how do we live the rules are very different. So I think if we can flip our training to be more scenario based, we might find more of an impact and maybe a change in behavior.
And you've studied this immensely. What are there, like when you walk into an organization, you say, let me understand how you're protecting yourself from the most obvious or the most egregious kinds of fraud. Are there specific things you look for?
Well, what I try to do when I'm going into a client and I'm doing a training session, I use a lot of games and a lot of stories and a lot of scenarios. And I want to get them talking to hear their opinion. And it's fascinating. So I'm going to put in the chat for everyone here the game I'm talking about, because they're just short snippets, short vignettes of almost what would you do? Things as easy as you ordered a briefcase, you bought one, and the next day a second one came. What do? Do you sell it? Do you return it? Or do you just keep it and have two? And those kinds of situations start knitting or picking at people's rationalization. You would be surprised, Rita, how many large corporate audiences of people, compliance people, accounting people, CFOs have said, oh, that's the company's fault they sent the bag to me. I'm keeping it, or I'm going to keep it and sell it. So you start to really understand when you throw people in a situation, what they actually would do. So a lot of times when I'm going in and I'm doing a workshop, I start with a situation and almost do a polling so I can get a feel for how people are viewing things. Now, my toughest audiences have been FBI agents and governmental auditors. They are by the book and they don't budge. If this is the rule, they're following it. There's no discussion there. You know, if the reimbursement policy says under $10 and it's $9.95 or $10.02, they're reporting it. Like, you know, they follow the rules. That's been my hardest audience. But a lot of times it's important for me to almost do a fraud assessment of what people think is fraudulent versus what they don't, because you would be surprised how lenient we all are when you start throwing people in a scenario.
Mm-hmm. Super interesting. So one of our viewers wants to know, can you give examples of behaviors which would throw up, you call them red flags in the book, you know, which sort of alert you to maybe I should be dialing into this a little more closely.
Okay. So that's a very broad question. So behaviors. Okay. I think, this is a, so I got to give you a scenario first and then the behaviors match that. So just a general blanket of behaviors wouldn't be helpful, but I think a red flag for me, if I was going into an organization and there were no, first of all, there was no compliance policy, there was no documented ethics training, there was no person in charge, that would be a red flag. Second, if you have a financial person, say for instance, they are retiring or they are moving on to another position and they're not willing to train anyone or they're not willing to explain their process, that would be a red flag. If you have a CPA or an auditing person that if you ask a basic question and they can't answer it, that would be a red flag because accounting is so, it balances. So any good accountant should be able to answer a basic question, even above basic question. So those would be a red flag. If people that I'm asking financial information sort of give me the runaround, that would be a red flag for me. So just giving you some general scenarios. I don't know if that answers the question, but if, you know, there are more red flags around life than they're not, you know, so I'm almost scared to move at this point because everything tends to be like, this could be iffy.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was kind of scary in the book was you talk about innocent bystanders, right? You know, so we're at the mercy of systems that we're not in charge of designing. And you use the example of an Airbnb that you rented.
Yes. So we were having our house renovated and we rented an Airbnb and it was too cheap. It was too good to be true. That was a red flag. And I ignored it because I wanted it to be cheap. That's
you wanted it to be true, right? We do. We want these things to be true.
I mean, and the reality is, high quality and super low cost and in a great location tend to all not go together, you know, but that's what I wanted. So that's what I saw. So I ignored everything else. Come to find out it was just like a big scam. But, you know, our desires sometimes influence what we see. And so, that was my Airbnb scam, but there's tons of Airbnb scams. But when you think about the innocent bystander category, we are so vulnerable that we don't really think about it. There's a story in the book about Dr. Robert Courtney. And so his story is not only in the intentional perpetrator category or chapter, but it's also in the innocent bystander chapter. Now, let me tell you what he did. Dr. Courtney was a compound pharmacist. So this is the pharmacist that you don't see in the CVS and the Walgreens. This is the pharmacist that is actually making your drugs that you might use. And so Robert Courtney was diluting cancer patient drugs so that he could increase his profit margin. Now, here's the problem with that. If you are 65 years old, stage three or four, let's say stage three, prostate cancer. You go to your oncologist, you get treated, you get your chemo, you get your IV, the nurse puts the bag on the stand and you're receiving your medication. There is no way you know and can test if what you're getting is what you're supposed to get. You just assume and trust the process that if I'm supposed to get a certain type of drug, that's what's dripping into my vein to save my life. Well, what he was doing was not putting the correct dosage in those bags. Some of those bags were fully saline solution. Now, what was happening? Yes. So I talk about Dr. Courtney in my intentional perpetrator category because he intentionally defrauded. He knew that the victims, if a stage three or four, 65, 70-year-old patient passes away, no one's really going to question it, right? Because Why would you? But what happened, what he didn't anticipate is the nurse. The nurse was a whistleblower. And the nurse, I would classify her as almost like a vigilante whistleblower, because what she started to notice was the cancer patients weren't experiencing the traditional chemotherapy side effects, fatigue, nausea, hair loss. And she was really shocked when she said, "You are a stage 3 or 4 patient receiving intense chemo. You should be showing these traditional side effects." And their tumors were growing. They weren't shrinking. They were growing. And so she started to get really concerned. She said something to the doctor, and the doctor's response was, "Everybody responds to chemotherapy differently." And that's a standard. You know, you hear people say that all the time. I mean, it's almost like the standard thing a doctor would say. And so she took that and sort of sat with it for a while, and then started to notice something is wrong here. She took a bag of chemo, sent it to the FDA, and they tested it and found that those samples that she sent had very little medication. Some of them were just saline solution. So that's how the case started. So when you think about being an innocent bystander, how would you test it? I mean, if you go and you get a prescription filled at your local pharmacy, how are you going to go home and perform some type of scientific testing to make sure it is what it says, what you thought it was? There's no way. So there's so many instances where we are just at the mercy of the goodness of someone else, which is why I think we have to elevate, celebrate, support whistleblowers, because if we don't have them, then we can't operate freely in the world like we do. We need them. We need someone willing to stand up and speak up.
Well, and I think we also, it also shows to me the importance of institutions. You know, if you think about manufactured food, you know, years and years ago, before we had rules around what you could put in food, and food began to be manufactured at scale, I mean, it was just horrible. Mm-hmm. Fraudulent behavior. And so what ends up happening is the institutions eventually catch up and you start to see rules in place and things like, and the food industry fought this like crazy, but eventually the Food and Drug Administration said, "No, we're going to send inspectors into your plant." Like,
before, as they should.
Well, right. But before that decision was made, the prevailing rule was, no, you know, my plant, my property, nobody has any business being on it. And it took an institution, the FDA, to say, no, actually, we're going to rewrite that particular rule because you can't be trusted if we don't have on-site inspectors.
My students just did a case about a company who had very unclean, unhealthy factory policies and practices. And to your point, thank goodness we have someone, some agency policing the behaviors of others, because a lot of people will get away with whatever they can get away with.
And we see that, you know, this isn't in the book, but we see that a lot with environmental policies.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the whole acid rain thing, you know, the Western countries have fixed it. But in a lot of parts of the world, I'm thinking like India and parts of China, manufacturers are still getting away with putting these really noxious chemicals into the air. And so it's almost like if you're wealthy, you can afford to have these controls. And if you're not,
you are an innocent bystander.
You are an innocent bystander. You know, I was reminded of this. I was just recently at a thing called the Drucker Forum, which is a big GABFest that they hold in Vienna every year, to kind of build on the work of Peter Drucker. And one of the panels, which was fascinating, was about cybercrime. Mm. And the person that was leading the panel, she's an ex-IBM senior leader. And she was saying that what we're not appreciating about cybercrime is how expensive it is to protect yourself against it. And that increasingly over time, what we're going to see is this rich, poor divide that, governments and institutions and companies in less well-off countries are actually going to be far more likely to be victims because they just can't afford the protections necessary to, to protect themselves.
Cyber is something that, if there's one thing that should keep us all up at night, it's cybercrime.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, my poor assistant's experience over the last few days really is bringing it close to home, right? And, you know, as more and more of the world gets digital. And I do think it's kind of interesting because a lot of these big tech companies, and I'm wondering about this now, because a lot of these big tech companies have the position of, you know, try it first, ask permission later, get out, you know, be big, be building it fast. And they don't really think about, you know, have we put in place enough controls, enough protections so that people aren't always.
Cyber is concerning because, you know, you think about with the use of AI, which you can create, like, is this even me sitting here? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's maybe it's the Kelly bot. Maybe it's the AI version of Kelly.
Having a conversation with a really well-designed bot.
Right. It could be. I mean, you think about it, like, you can sound like me. You could be me. You could mimic me easily. You know, you could probably write like me at this point. So it's very concerning because we will have to really be able to decide what is real and what is fake and what is the definition of fake anymore, you know? So it's concerning how it has entered into the way we live. I think it's also concerning how much information that we have freely given up. You know, when I think about my parents' day, where privacy truly was a thing. Privacy now, I mean, what's private? I mean, everyone posts every aspect of everything that they're doing every minute of the day, you know, so being able to mimic someone else is much, much easier than you think 20 years ago. So the advancement of technology, I think, has just increased and helped fraud just spread even faster.
Well, and it's almost like whack-a-mole, right? As soon as we come up with a way of preventing one kind of fraud, something else pops up in its place. So one of the things that you mention in the book is these scams that are perpetrated against elderly people. So someone purporting to be your grandchild calls and they're in trouble and then could you send some money immediately? They need help. And, you know, many of us would be very vulnerable to that.
You know, the elderly are truly targets, and they're another innocent bystander category, because you think about the one thing that you do as you get older is you don't trust yourself as much as you used to. Maybe I do have a long lost cousin and maybe I am going to help, or maybe I haven't paid that account off, or maybe this tech person really is here to help me. Maybe I do need this upgrade and maybe they're going to help me. You begin to doubt yourself. And so I think that that's why they end up being targets. They tend to have more money. They tend to be more trusting and they tend to be less trusting of themselves. So they become a huge target.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, once you start reading, well, in my case, once I started reading your book, now I'm seeing fraud like everywhere.
It's it's all over the place. It's everywhere, you know, so that's why we have to make sure that we are able to recognize it. I'll tell you funner story. I just a couple of weeks ago, I'm in my office downtown Chicago, and I get a call on my phone, and the person says, "Is this Kelly Pope?" I'm like, "Sure." And they said, "Well, this is Officer," I'm just going to say Smith. I can't remember his last name. "This is Officer Smith. And I'm getting fire alarm sound from your house. And in order for us to clear this, we need to get into your house. I see that you have a Ring camera. Just open your door right now and we can go in so we can clear the alarm." Rita, I looked at the phone. I said, "Are you crazy? Like, do you really think I'm going to open my door?" So I said, "Let's hang this call up. Give me your phone number. Tell me your badge number. Let me call down to the police station. Verify you are who you say you are. And if my house burns down, it just burns down. There's no way I'm going to open my door and let you in, despite everything you're saying. I'm just, you know," so it's another one of the another technique of a fraudster is urgency. So you need to do this. You need to act fast. If you don't, something terrible can happen. And, you know, that's one thing you just sort of have to simmer that down. Now, make a long story short, it actually was the real police and actually did have an alarm. And it was just someone was doing some work in the basement. They had kicked something. So that's why this alarm went off. But still, I said, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not opening my door, but I could see how people could easily have fallen for that. And maybe my fraud red flags were just always going off. And I was just like, there's no way I'm falling for this, because even if you're, if you aren't who you say you aren't, when I tell this story, and if I say someone took everything out of my house, they're going to say, well, why would you open the door? So, right. But it's a crazy story. Like for someone to call you and say, do this now or else. Yeah. I'm good. Well, it's not going to happen that fast. If you don't see any flames right now, it's fine. Just, we're going to all take a step back, take a deep breath and handle it correctly.
Right. So I got a terrific email, which you as a filmmaker will appreciate. It was from Steven Spielberg. What he wanted to do was have me respond to him because he wanted to prepare my book, Discovery Driven Growth, for a pitch to make a movie out of the book. And I looked at the email address and it was like Steven Spielberg at DreamWorks. I mean, it had all the right words in it, right? And everything, but there were, you talk about red flags. So the first red flag is it's a business book. Like it's not that sexy. It's not a story. It's a bunch of techniques and tools for how you plan under uncertainty. So while I appreciate the modest recognition that this must have created, the topic doesn't make any sense for the book. And then I was thinking, oh yeah, but maybe I could get Meryl Streep to like play me with that.
Like you.
And then I just thought, Rita, this is just too stupid for words. And so I deleted it. But you know,
I wonder if you would have responded what they want it from you.
And I didn't want to put myself enough at risk to find out, but I was super curious.
Like, I wonder if eventually it was going to be your identity or your money. Like, I wonder what, you know, I guess it might've been something like pay us X dollars to represent you for the pitch. Maybe then, and then you would have given your credit card and then boom, everything would have just, the floodgates would have opened.
I'm sure it's something like that. But
that's a good one, though, but because it's flattery, you know, like, and you think about you do have enough pieces on the web for someone to say something to you that would make you say, well, maybe, you know, so it was enticing for a second.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's also interesting because one of the things you talk about with the whistleblowers that I find intriguing is we fall for these things sometimes because these perpetrators are appealing to, I'll call them lesser instincts, right? They're appealing to vanity or greed or our wish to look better. And so when the fraud is uncovered, we're actually embarrassed. We're like too embarrassed to say, actually, no, this isn't my fault. This is some perpetrator that did something wrong. We sort of accept some of the blame for it, which, you know, in our culture, like, as we were just saying, we're like, why did you open the door to this guy? You know?
Yeah. I mean, because we definitely are a blame culture. I mean, because if I had unlocked my door and let them in and it had been a scam, it would have been my fault. It would have been, I would have never been a victim. I would have been the gullible, silly homeowner who opened her door to people, to burglars. And that would have been the headline.
Right.
Accounting professor opens door for burglars. News at 11. You know, like that would have been the headline. But we victimize the victims in a way that should we? Because most of us might have responded the same way if we had been in the same situation.
Sure. And I think it people then feel ashamed of themselves. So our daughter used to work for the Manhattan District Attorney in the White Collar Crimes Division, while she was there, I remember just thinking to myself, God, I hope this job does not like destroy her faith in humanity for all time. But some of the crimes she was finding was, you know, guys that would appeal to these lonely women, and they might have six or seven of them on the string at the same time. And it's, oh, you know, I could come visit you if you just send me, you know, $10,000. Or whatever. And then eventually they found each other and you know, those kinds of things were revealed. But it's just you know, amazing what people will try to pull off.
And not only what they pull off, what they get away with, you know, because you think about appealing to, I've had a few friends of mine who've had parents, widowers who have fallen victim to those rom-com romance scams. And you know, it's just, you think about how easy it is to identify people, whether they might be somebody in a grief group that you befriend. Like we almost make it easy to find people that you can victimize because we group ourselves and cluster in ways that say, here we are, just pick me. And then you can just put your fangs into that person and just take them for everything. It's really terrible when that happens.
It's so sad.
I think I'm too mean now. I think I'm too mean and evil to let that happen, that a rom-com happen.
Well, it does, you know, one of the things your book does do is really increase awareness of just how, A, how easy, and B, how prevalent it is. And then I guess how much we really depend on other people having at least, maybe not our best interest, but at least a do no harm philosophy. And that's not necessarily true. So let's start on whistleblowers, because I think that's a really key part of this. And something I hadn't really appreciated till reading your book was how often our institutional protections come after someone's blown the whistle. And so you talk about four kinds. So accidental, noble, vigilante whistleblowers, and crossovers, which I think is interesting. So I guess what it made me realize was sometimes somebody has to be willing to uncover the harm before we actually put in place rules around
that's it. True. And yeah. What's interesting about all of those categories is my goal was really focusing in naming the categories on their motives of whistleblowing. But every last category, they're not celebrated. They are bullied, harassed, demonized. Whether you're an accidental probably has it the least amount, because the accidental whistleblower's motivation is really by accident, by mistake. And so I think because they just sort of stumble upon it, people seem to be a little less harsh on their treatment. You know, I was doing my job and I just happened to see this entry and I just reported it. I didn't, you know, like my goal was not to try to seek this out. But the noble whistleblowers and the vigilante whistleblowers, we hate them. I mean, we absolutely hate anybody that is willing to step outside of the group to say something different. And what does that say about us as a society? We do not like a person that says something counter to what everybody else is saying, even if they're right. You know, and so the noble whistleblower is the person that is amongst that group. Let's say they are a safety engineer and they notice that their team is not following the safety protocols. And they know everybody on the team knows the safety protocols. And so they're the person that says, hey, wait a minute, we're not following this and we should be, and I'm going to report this. Well, that person isn't wrong. But when they do, that team turns on them. That's the noble whistleblower. The difference between the noble and the vigilante whistleblower, vigilantes, they are ready for the war. If it has to do with them or not, they are reporting it. So say, for instance, I always like to describe the vigilante whistleblower as they are the elderly person that is sitting in the window, making sure no one speeds down your street. And if they see someone speeding, they're going to write that license plate down and they're going to call the police station and say, you need to find this person and ticket them, because at 11:15, they were speeding and there were three kids out on the street. Now, is that person wrong for what they've done? They're not wrong. It's intense, but we need people that would do that, right? Because they do help keep our communities and our organizations safe. But they all get a negative bad rap. Somebody that's willing to speak out is not a celebrated person, and they actually should be.
Well, and we had an incident like that personally, quite unintentional. We were unintentional perpetrators, or how would we fall into that? We were accidental perpetrators.
Okay.
So what had happened was our son moved into this townhouse development in Pennsylvania, and we drove there and helped him move. And he has like a little driveway, and he put his car in the driveway and we put our car right in front of his car on the street. And we thought, you know, we're not blocking anybody else in. It's just one night. Blah, 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 blah. And so come down in the morning and there's a big post-it note written, like, there's no parking on this street. And there's also a ticket from the local police. Now, we had not parked there till it was easily 11 o'clock at night. So this is exactly what you're describing. Somebody looked out the window and said, oh, there's a car parked on the street. I mean, you're not.
And you weren't bothering anyone, right?
No, you're not going to tell me the police are like patrolling this area at 11 o'clock at night looking for parked cars. So, you know, I mean, and we were totally in the wrong. I mean, I'm not trying to be defensive about it, but it was sort of like a $10 ticket for this, for like what? You know, but it's a great example of that kind of vigilante model, right?
Yeah, exactly. There, I've just looked over at the chat. There was a question, a whistleblower question I wanted to ask. It was someone had just posted it. You mind me answering it?
Sure, sure, go ahead.
So it says, in your experience, do whistleblowers, can they change their companies? Do the employers market want former whistleblowers? That is a question. So here's the interesting thing to that question is whistleblowers attempt to change companies. Nobody wants them. So once you are known as bringing something forward and you have that profile or that stigma, it's very difficult to find another job. And this is the thing. Why? If you brought something forward that was of concern that everybody needed to know, why are you now untrustworthy? Why? And that was really my question. I did a TED Talk a couple years back, and it was entitled, Why Do We Hate Whistleblowers? You know, and that really was my question. Like, why do we hate the person that is willing to come forward and tell the truth about an injustice? Why do we hate that person? We don't hate the person that's doing the injustice. We hate the person that's talking about it. And so another point, no one wants honesty. And I unfortunately have to agree with some aspect of that, because seeing what happens, the destruction of that whistleblower when they say something, even if they're right, it's just, we don't want to hear that. And so it's very difficult for them to find another job or find support, especially if it's a public case. And I'm speaking from my sample of whistleblowers that I've interviewed over the years and just watching their journeys and how difficult it has been for them. And they are in the right. So my takeaway is, how can we elevate and celebrate a person that is willing to do that? Because that is hard. The whistleblower journey, I think, may be harder than the perpetrator journey. And, you know, you may or may not agree, but just think about this. Once the perpetrator does their time and they come back into society, you know, we understand that they may have speaking, they may have a book, they might have something that, but we are more accepting than that whistleblower person who could have kept their mouth shut, chose not to share, to protect others. So we have to change that. And so that was my hope with my TED Talk. That is my hope with the whistleblower chapters in the book, of how can we elevate and celebrate them more than isolate and demonize them.
Well, and what it makes me think of is, you know, Amy Edmondson, who just got voted the number one thinker in the world, and her book just won, her book, which is called Right Kind of Wrong. It's about failure and how we can fail well. But her big construct is a thing called psychological safety. And she points out that in many situations, which are potentially dangerous, it's the person who's willing to speak up that saves the day. And she began studying this in hospitals, and her initial discovery was that she had a hypothesis. She was working for a very famous psychologist at Harvard, and she was his graduate student. And the hypothesis was that teams that were high performing in hospitals would experience lower rates of medical errors. And what she found when she looked at the data was that this was not supported, that these teams that were evaluated by a separate party were actually reporting more medical errors. But then, what, luckily for her, a third investigation took place, which examined the actual rate of medical errors, going back and looking at the actual procedure that was administered or whatever, and doing some comparisons. And what she found was that the teams that were regarded as being more effective, that were higher performing, were more comfortable admitting to medical errors than the teams that weren't. And so her whole you know, body of work has really been about how important it is for high complexity, high risk situations for people to be open to speaking up. And then here you are basically saying, no, we actually hate those people.
You know, that is one of my books to read. I hope that I can read it this holiday season. And I'll tell you why I'm intrigued by it is I have not worked in an environment where I feel like I can fail, So I'm intrigued to hear about how one fails correctly, because I think a lot of it is your leadership, your environment, your industry, and the acceptance of, can you fail? I think it has to do with your gender and your race as well. So I'm just curious. I know that's on my books to read, because I just don't know. I've never worked anywhere where I felt like the state, well, being a professor, there's low stakes. You failing in the classroom, you know, so you, right. So maybe you thought it was, you were on chapter five, you were on chapter four, not that kind of failure. I've never been in a situation where I've worked in a high stakes area and I felt like I could. So that's one of my must reads.
I'll give you a quick preview. So what Amy does is she talks about, categorizing failure into three classes, right? So there's basic failures, which are the stupid ones, right? You didn't follow a procedure, you didn't, you know, dot the I's, you didn't fill out the form, you did something that you should have done. And we want to identify and root out and correct those. Then there's intelligent failures. And an intelligent failure is a situation where there's genuine uncertainty. We really don't know. And so the only way you're going to learn what you need to learn is by doing some kind of experiment to test a hypothesis. And as any scientist will tell you,
Mm-hmm.
And hypotheses are sometimes not supported, but you have to frame it in the right way. And I think Amy makes that point very clear. And then there's the class, which kind of overlaps with your work a bit, which she calls complex systems failures. So these are things like the air traffic control system, right? And if you think about it, why is traveling by air in the United States, even though we moan and whine about it, why is it so safe? It's so safe because there are institutional rules, not just that you should report accidents, you have to, you know,
So the environment is set up to encourage
There is a mistake, even if it's your mistake, like instead of hiding it, you're required to report it. So that they can evaluate it if a procedure needs to be changed or something. And the results have been remarkable. So it can happen. It can happen.
So we just need to create those environments where speaking up is rewarded more.
Exactly.
And maybe that'll help the whistleblower.
Right. So we have a comment from Greg Keyes, who says he's an accidental whistleblower. Pointed out legitimate medical device quality and regulatory violation, suspended, forced into psychological assessment, issued a performance improvement plan, and forced to resign/retire.
Oh, wow.
So kind of a living case study. Thank you for sharing your story, Greg.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to put something, a little homework assignment for those that are here with us today. I'm just going to put this in the chat, and I'm just doing it right now. So it's a test that you can play.
Great.
And it will tell you what type of whistleblower, perpetrator you are. Are you still here? Let's see.
We're here.
Okay. All right. You know, sometimes you're moving around the screens, you lose the screen. Okay. So let me put this in the chat right now. And you can play this later. And I'm just put it there. And you click on that. And there's two, it's going to give you two paths. You can either report fraud or you can commit fraud. If you report fraud, it will tell you, are you an accidental whistleblower, a noble whistleblower, or a vigilante whistleblower? If you play the commit fraud path, it'll tell you, are you an intentional perpetrator, an accidental perpetrator, or a righteous perpetrator? So all of the scenarios that are in the game are built off of similar stories in the book. So when you're reading it, you might say, it told me I was a tie between these two chapters or these two profiles. I'm gonna read a little bit more about those. So fun little game to sort of relate, make the book more of an active reading experience.
I love that. So with the advent of AI, I mean, you can't have a conversation these days without bringing AI into it somewhere. The thing I worry about is, doesn't it just like dramatically expand the universe of potential ways people can
In the fraud research world, I think for the past maybe 30, 40 years, or 50 years, we've been talking about the same types of schemes. AI is going to bring a whole new set of schemes. And I don't I don't know if we're prepared for it, but we're going to, there's going to be a whole new type.
Well, I had one that actually happened to me. So I was interacting with somebody on LinkedIn, not somebody I know very well, but this person sent me a message and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And incidentally, in the context of this conversation, said, oh, I'm so pleased to see that you partnered with the Board of Innovation to do this like advanced AI application. And I said, Board of Innovation, I mean, I know who they are, but I've got no relationship with them. So I quickly searched and found that they had put me up on their website with the tag phrase, personalized strategy at inexpensive prices, personalized strategy without the expensive price tag, something like that. And what they had done was they had this bot that was purporting to be me. And to add insult to injury, if you ask the bot a question, it came back with like complete hallucination. It was totally not what I would have in that situation. So I posted about it on LinkedIn and I wrote to the Board of Innovation. I said, what are you doing? And I got back this very mushy sort of, oh, well, we were doing some experiments, putting a wrapper around it, and, you know, we're sorry. And they took it down. But it was like, dude, it's like if I hadn't reached out to them, they'd still be doing it. It was
that is not
okay. And so I'm also part of a group of authors that we are talking about. And many of the people in the group have had their books, their entire books, sort of ingested into this generative AI without any regard to copyright. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is public domain stuff.
Is it a summary of their book? Is that what
the whole book? There's a dark web website where the entire text of these copyrighted books can be just simply uploaded for free. I've got three of mine that are in this data set. So there's a whole kind of copyright who owns what.
That's what I'm talking about. Those are the new schemes that we haven't even started to think about. And so that might be our next project, Rita.
There you go.
We're going to do an AI scam book together. There we go.
Scam book together. Like as I'm talking to you, I've got all these examples. It's wild.
So you do.
Tell us how we can learn more. How do we become part of your world? What are some things we could do going forward?
Sure. Well, definitely connect on all social platforms. That's LinkedIn. I try to stay pretty active there. And I'm working on a new documentary about a couple that has been wrongfully accused, in my opinion, of a healthcare fraud situation. The name of that film is Truth Be Told. Haven't come up with the tagline yet, so that's what I'm working on. So hopefully that will be completed in 2024. But please connect on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I don't always tweet at all. X. I don't know what we call it now. If it's Xing, I don't know what we're doing, what we're calling it now. But I'm definitely on LinkedIn and on Instagram, and I try to stay pretty active there. And I will definitely put my email in the chat if anybody wants to reach out. Please do. If you have a good fraud story, please let me know that too, because I love a good story. And I appreciate the time with you today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. So just as we go out, the book again is Fool Me Once. It's really a fun read. You know, Christmas is coming, just saying.
It's a great gift.
It's a great gift, right? And it's a fun read and very, very kind of illuminating. And by the way, you know, maybe it could give you some clues as to how to avoid being a victim. So if we can avoid a couple of those happening, that would be worth the time, right?
So, absolutely. I'm also putting my the name of my documentary. If you want to watch a good movie tonight, it's Friday night, movie night, grab some popcorn.
There you go. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for spending the time, and I'm looking forward to future interactions. Thanks.
Same. Thank you so much, Rita.